It's the network break. Brew a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Pack of Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and with me is the impertinent Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you?
Well, I'm feeling all something today. I've been out to the gym, and there's a boxing bag there. And if there's one thing I like at the gym, mind you, don't feel like I'm a fitness fanatic. I'm not. But I love getting up there and giving the punching bag some hoo-ah.
That's really cathartic to go out and hit something that you don't get in trouble for hitting.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And nobody yells at you when you do it.
Just that's right. Excellent. Well, good. And now you can do some verbal punching. And before we dive into the news, I want to thank our sponsor, Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. So let Riverbed, the application performance company, accelerate your software-driven enterprise. So the big story for me this week was the kerfuffle between Apple and the FBI. The FBI went to a magistrate judge in the federal court of Central California and said, hey, Apple, we have this phone that we got from an alleged terrorist that killed 14 people in San Bernardino, California last year. We want you to unlock it. Apple has said, no, we are not going to do that.
Yeah, and there's two sides to the argument here, of course. There's the political and there's the technical. Let's cover the technical first because that's easy here. The first is that it's an Apple 5C. And the 5C doesn't have a secure enclave on the chip. So theoretically, if Apple cuts a version of the operating system specifically for the serial number of that phone, then you can load it into the phone with suitable modifications to bypass the PIN numbers.
Right, to bypass the lockout feature.
The lockout feature in the phone. And that would then allow them to try, you know, put a machine on it to type in all possible PIN numbers until they crack into it.
Yeah, they'll brute force it.
Brute force it, right? So, and to their credit, the FBI said, we will bring you the phone. It will never leave your premises. We don't want the code. We know this is how it can be done. Apple can do that for us, right?
Yes.
So unlike the iPhone 5S and later 6, 6S and so forth, this system wouldn't work on those phones. The more modern phones have the secure enclave chip, and they can never be cracked using that method because you can't load a thing to ignore the PIN number. You actually have to have the secure enclave. That does not mean, of course, that Apple does not necessarily have the ability to write code to ignore the secure enclave, and therefore the FBI could get access to other people's phones in the future. So technologically, Apple doesn't have to fight this particular one because the 5C was never secure in the first place, which leads me to conclude that Apple is in a situation of it's choosing to fight now, not in a year or two's time. A. B, if it gave in now and then started to fight it later on saying, no, our phones can't be hacked, then the FBI would say, well, you've done it once, you can do it again, and it's bad politics. I think they have to make a stand now.
Yeah, I've been going back and forth on this and reading a lot about it and thinking a lot about it. Part of the issue, you said it's both legal and technical. On the legal side, the crux, I think, that Apple is saying, aside from we don't want to, you know, violate the security of our own products, is that it's not that they have this tool that they could, you know, hand over to the FBI to use. It's that the government is saying you must create this tool that will weaken the security of your product and allow us to use it. And they're saying that sets a bad precedent going forward.
Yes, and I think the challenge here, in my opinion, is it might be entirely correct for a government to request, in the case of the people who, you know, this was a terrorist attack, a husband and wife, and went and shot people at random, the government would like to know more to be able to investigate, you know, how it got them, what happened. But I would also like to ask, what happens when the Chinese government takes Apple in a court of law?
Right.
And says, you have to make a special version for us. Oh, and we get to keep the code, and we're going to make it law that you have to give us a back door.
Right. And I think that's an argument that a lot of people who are saying Apple shouldn't cooperate with the government are saying, that if Apple does it for the United States, then every other government on the planet is going to say, hey, we want the same thing.
Yes.
Although part of me also feels like, I don't know how good that argument is, because China or Russia or any other government could say to Apple, oh, we know this is possible now, and so going forward, when we come to you with this request, you make it or you don't get to sell your products in our country. So, yeah, that's
why. One of the most entirely disgusting parts about this is the Google CEO came out and said, yeah, we can see where Apple's going and we can see why they're doing it. Thanks.
That's it. Right.
And it was very interesting to watch the press articles talk about. One person was saying Google CEO comes out in favor of Apple's position on encryption, you know, encrypting devices. Mm-hmm. And then other people coming out and saying, actually, what he did was said nothing at all. He doesn't want to be drawn into it. He doesn't make right. a stand. Isn't going to be against it and isn't going to be for it. It's like, well, you know, we make our money out of, you know, stealing as much data about our customers as possible. We don't want to enter into that debate at all. You know? No, we probably don't want our customers' data to be stolen because we want it all.
That's right.
And that's a thin red line.
It is. And who knows what, you know, how Google has already cooperated with the government in terms of requesting access to data that Google may have. And so they can see the bear trap and don't want to put their foot in it until they absolutely have to, until a situation like this bubbles up around an Android phone.
Mm. Well, Android phones are so insecure. I mean, like this week, I've seen like a half a dozen level one critical vulnerabilities that you could drive a truck through. The code is tremendously badly written. Even the native Google Android code is bad. But even when the OEMs take it and then put their own stuff on top, which is all very badly written, Samsung, Huawei, you know, all those companies, owning an Android phone is not something that you could recommend to anybody, really. Mm-hmm. They're dreadfully insecure and being compromised in vast numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of companies coming out in support of Apple. So we've seen companies like Twitter come out in support of a range of other .coms, you know, like website companies. I'm not sure about Facebook again. They haven't said anything that I've seen. Not surprising when, you know, privacy theft is basically Facebook's whole game. You know, I think good for Apple for standing up for it. And I think the best article I saw came from Bruce Schneier in the Washington Post. And basically he said, it's a very, very simple decision here. The FBI, any form of security around personal devices comes down to either everyone gets security or no one does.
Mm-hmm.
And if the FBI chooses, for whatever reason, as a systemic body, to tear down security in any technology, then no one is secure in the world from sure. anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. So U.S. citizens are vulnerable to anybody externally, the GCHQ, the Australian DOD, Hong Kong, China, Africa, Chinese government, Russian government, because mm-hmm. the thing is that a U.S. government body needs to be taking a bigger picture. And by making U.S. citizens insecure globally for the sake of one event is a very difficult moral decision, right?
That's the thing, though. Here's where I guess I'm usually gung-ho privacy, you know, personal information being secure, having the government not be snooping. I feel like this is a slightly different case, though, because the mechanism we're talking about isn't like broad, unwarranted, you know, mass surveillance. This is an individual phone. You have to have possession of the phone. You have to write special software to get access to the phone. You know, it's a one-to-one. It's not a let's sniff a wire and pull all the data off it and we get everything from everyone. So that's where I feel like the argument, the privacy argument starts to break down a little bit, because honestly, this is a case where I feel like law enforcement has, you know, legal and material interest in the contents of this phone. It's not broad-based unwarranted surveillance. It's an actual investigation of a crime. So I understand, I think, Apple's position, and I'm definitely pro-privacy, but I also feel like there is an argument that can be advanced that does sort of put Apple on the wrong foot. I'm really not sure. I'm having a hard time with this issue.
Yeah. So morally, they're correct. For the specific issue at hand, morally, they are correct. And legally, you can make a case that this is necessary. But in the overall picture of – and in terms of the jurisdiction of the court wants what the court wants.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
And it wants to be able to, you know, solve the little tiny issue in front of it. It has no responsibility to society at large.
Mm-hmm.
It has no responsibility to the people of the world. The court can only consider the issue that's in front of it.
Right.
What it doesn't consider is the overall security of the country, of the state that it's in, or the country that it's in, or indeed the global position, what this would disrupt as a global issue.
Mm-hmm.
And So if you want to get a parallel story, let's talk about gun debates, right?
Okay.
People want to have a gun in their home so that they can protect themselves. Mm-hmm. But what's the cause of the most gun deaths in the U.S. today?
Accidental shootings.
Accidental shootings because there's a gun in the house. You can understand the moral issue that you want to own a gun because of fear of house invasion, but you shouldn't allow it to happen because the bigger picture is people die from having guns in the house.
Mm-hmm. So, that doesn't seem like a similar case, though, because you're talking about a personal choice of owning a gun.
It's a I'm talking about the morality of it.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about the morality of the decision that the court's making, that they should be willing to help them out. But the morality is that owning a gun is almost guaranteed to get you killed in your, you know, there's a higher risk in your home by owning a gun. But your fear of, you know, not being able to defend yourself may be greater than you think the risk is. Now, that is a very bad personal decision based on the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the morality of that decision. It's the same decision here with encryption. Once you start to allow guns out, the corresponding thing is that you're killing more of your citizens by accident. If we give encryption away, once it's done, nobody's safe.
But we aren't giving encryption away. We're not weakening encryption. We're going after, you know, a mechanism that invokes the encryption, which is
once we go down this, yeah, you're talking about the specific technology problem. Open it up, right?
Yep.
Once we go down the path of breaking encryption and forcing companies against their commercial principles, and capitalism be damned, right? You're pregnant. You're not half pregnant. You're not a little bit pregnant. Encryption in devices is over. Every government in the world is going to legislate to make a backdoor in it, and the whole topic is dead.
Mm-hmm.
You're either everybody's secure or no one is secure.
Well, this is a case that I think we're going to be talking about more and more because there's still a lot more to go here. So we'll definitely be coming back to this. And I love the fact that we're talking about morality on this show. That's nice.
We can go there.
We can go there. We should invite a philosopher on for next week.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Somebody who really knows this stuff.
Yeah, tell us what idiots we are. Mm-hmm. So sticking with security, this story jumped out at me this week. A hospital in Los Angeles, apparently some ransomware got onto one of its systems, and so a bunch of hospital data got locked up, encrypted, and the hospital eventually was forced to pay the attackers a ransom to get the decryption key so that they could unlock their medical data. Apparently, the story I found was from England, so it's £12,000. I'm not really sure what that is in dollars, but it was 40 bitcoins that Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center had to pay out to get some of its data unencrypted.
Boo-hoo. I mean, I feel for the healthcare industry who've been ignoring IT security for a very long time and sort of pretending it can't happen to us while, you know, beating their chests about, you know, health data is privacy protected and can't be shared and belongs to the patient and doctors don't work with law enforcement and all that sort of stuff. But the software platforms that their data is held on and the devices that they use are all horrendously insecure.
Yeah.
And the bodies that regulate such technology and have oversight of these appliances, I still don't have any policies around technology. So fundamentally, the IT security around hospitals is hopeless. And if you've ever worked in a hospital, you'll just shake your head and you instantly leave and go and find a serious career somewhere else. And this is what's going to happen.
What's interesting to me is that it looks like the hospital wasn't specifically a target of this ransomware attack. It happened to just be floating around out in the ether and landed on presumably in someone's inbox in a phishing email. They clicked on a link, activated the malware, and it went and started doing its dirty business. But that's the fact that it was random almost scares me a little bit more, because I'm sure there are folks out there who are like, oh yeah, hospitals, let's go get them.
I don't think it was deliberately targeting a hospital. It was just
It was just opportunistic.
Yeah. Thing is that for $20,000, £12,000 today is around about $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
Cheap money.
Well, and that's
the people who are doing it aren't kicking the ass out of her. You know, they're not trying to, you know, overdo it. They didn't ask for a million. They just asked for enough to make it painless enough to pay them some money. And you know,
You
can have several good nights out with that sort of money.
Yeah, several
in Russia. Vodka, not too badly priced. Very cheap. It's very cheap.
But this is also a lot more serious than having credit card data stolen, because it could affect medical care and people's health outcomes. So I'm disturbed by this.
You obviously haven't worked in healthcare.
I haven't worked in healthcare, but I have been. I have had my health cared for.
Yes.
So I know what a lousy healthcare system it is.
Healthcare is a very difficult business to be in, right?
Yes.
All of the records are still held in paper. They're not very often digitized. The systems they put them in are hopelessly insecure because they focus on being accessible at all times. They have to be. That's the
definition.
They do. Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very difficult to put security in. Your health data is never secure. They're usually written in arcane languages. They're often 20 to 40 years old. They're heirloom assets that should have been shot, taken out the back and shot, or you know, broken up and fed to a fire. It's not surprising, and he's hoping that it'll do something, but I doubt it will. Not a big enough deal to really matter.
No, probably not. I mean, we'll see if lawsuits come out of it, but as we've seen from other industries, everyone assumes it can't happen to me, and they see these warning signs and go, well, yeah, all right, it's fine.
Boom.
Yeah, we're all doomed. That's the summary. We're all doomed. Don't get sick. Maybe there's some advice for listeners. If you can avoid it. another story that I found this week, Marvel, the semiconductor company, Marvel, not the comic book behemoth in the United States, Marvel, the semiconductor company. Apparently they settled a long-running patent lawsuit with Carnegie Mellon University here in the United States. And according to Ars Technica, it's the second largest technology-related payment. Carnegie Mellon and Marvel agreed to a $750 million payout. Carnegie Mellon, there are two professors, one professor and one who was at the time graduate student, had a couple of patents on some technology. I think initially they won their original suit against Marvel, and then for a substantial payout, $1.7 billion, but then Marvel appealed, and now they've settled on $750 million. But wow, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, there's a lot of, if I remember this is to do with noise on a hard disk drive.
Yes.
And quite how Marvel infringed on these payments. I mean, who really cares? These things, and this has been going since 2004. So if I remember rightly, I think part of the distress here was that the university suddenly decided that they would start patenting technologies that they had and then didn't do anything about them and then all of a sudden decided they could make money as the education for profit thing started to rise up and funding for education started to drop away. They started to exercise their patent portfolios, fundamentally catching public companies unawares. So in a sense, while it's good for Carnegie Mellon, it's actually been a curse because now a lot of universities have been monetized and they run patent portfolios for profit, which is fine because they often develop them. But now a lot of their research programs are no longer focused on fundamental research. They're focused on producing patents so the university can monetize them. And
it sounds like the business school might have talked to them.
Well, once you get a sniff of, you know, I could get 750 million right. for my university that probably, you know, only makes a billion a year. Well, that's a bit of a win, right? So,
yeah.
But the problem is, of course, is that universities stop working on fundamental research and then start to focus on the revenue. So they start to generally shift their research efforts into how many patents can you produce and reward your professors for results. And you end up with this, I'm going to be that the fundamental research doesn't happen.
Yeah, I could see that becoming an issue. Although without the fundamental research, you don't get to do the patents. The bigger issue to me is that our whole patent system in the United States is just screwed up royally, and we need a major rethink on how patents are issued.
It's a worldwide, it's not unique to the United States, although arguably the United States system is least best.
We lead the world in being worst at patent law.
I wouldn't say worst, but let's say less than best.
Okay.
Certainly that's where we seem to have a lot of trouble. The US market is so disproportionately large and valuable that patent cases in the US do dominate the global scenario. And that's really, and if it's less than excellent, which it is, I would think, you need to sort of be able to live with it, not criticize it, I suppose.
All right. Before we move on with the rest of the news, I want to thank today's sponsor, Riverbed. You've heard of Riverbed. They've been working to ensure applications perform at their peak for more than 26,000 companies. They've got a platform for providing end-to-end visibility, optimization, and control across the entire enterprise. And that means you get visibility to see everything that impacts the performance of your apps, whether it's code, the network, user experience, so you can detect and fix issues instantly. Riverbed accelerates delivery of any app regardless of distance and steers the apps over the best network for maximum performance and the lowest TCO. And Riverbed also simplifies hybrid IT operations while securing applications and data to minimize the risk and ensure business continuity. And be sure to catch our upcoming weekly show podcast with Riverbed. Greg and Ethan are talking with Riverbed about the company's role in driving innovation in open source and security and more. And for instance, Riverbed is a corporate sponsor of Wireshark, and that's the popular packet analyzer. And they're going to talk about Riverbed's involvement there. So your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. Let Riverbed accelerate your software-driven enterprise. And thanks, Riverbed, for being a sponsor. A couple of stories about private cloud. Now, you and I work on the Human Infrastructure magazine that folks can sign up for, and you've got an article in there for our most recent issue about why we don't hear that much about private cloud versus public cloud deployments. And if you want to talk about that for a minute, that'll sort of set the stage for where we're going.
So we don't hear a lot about people who've deployed successful private clouds. We only hear about people doing public clouds, right? You and I know this.
Yes.
It's like my inbox is full of people crowing about running Docker on the public cloud or serverless public cloud or PaaS on the public cloud or Google's public cloud.
Right, and we talked last week about Netflix about finally being all in on public cloud.
Yeah, and it took them 10 years to get there, you know. Right. It didn't happen in 1 year. Netflix isn't all public cloud. It took years and years and years of, you know, massive investment and constant attraction of the thing. And I sat down and thought about what is it that drives company on the public cloud to be public, to actually go and talk about their technology in the cloud. And I came up with I've got seven topics here, right? One is recruiting. The biggest one I've ever heard of is people go out there and talk about their public cloud initiatives because they need to go and recruit more people. Now, recruiting is expensive. You're looking, you know, I've heard stories of up to $40,000 in recruiting fees to hire people in this space. Yeah. If you can go and speak at a conference and then start rubbing shoulders with people doing the same thing as you and then recruiting them, you could actually save a lot of money.
That's right.
Right? So that's one. Two, marketing. If you're a household brand or you want to be a household brand, if you're, you know, Amazon Cloud or if you're Netflix or if you're, you know, any of these other companies that are in there, speaking at technology conferences and hopefully getting into the newspapers is actually cheap marketing.
Well, that's true. The media loves to cover a public cloud story.
Well, they love to cover a public cloud story because there's lots of public cloud stories to cover. And, you know, these companies are, it's not often you actually get insights into what companies are doing internally, and they'll stand up on stage and talk all about the internals of their company. Because for them, it's marketing, and marketing is good because they're paying so much for the public cloud, they probably can't afford to do marketing. Right? Anyway, on the other. A lot of companies decide to open source. The third reason I had is that open source participation. If you put your, let's say Netflix and all these companies are doing open source projects, and then they push them out into the open source. And the reason for that, again, is financial. Follow the money. Follow the money. Why do you put your project into open source? Because you want other companies to come and use your software so that they start allocating developers, so that they start contributing to your open source platform, which you can then bring back in-house. Mm-hmm. Or they can find bugs. Or they can take the product in a new direction, which then brings more value into your company. So getting open source participation actually helps at the bottom line of these companies. So I'm sure that that some people do open source from the goodness of their hearts, but I'm pretty sure their executives send them out there because it's good for the bottom line.
Right.
Right. And second part, if you take an open source project and put it out there, guess what you're doing? Recruiting gets even easier because your open source project is a target pool of fish in a barrel that you can go and hunt down and recruit onto your company.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So open source projects have this dual capability of, you know, easy to recruit people, and they're able to write and work on your custom software that you fundamentally built for your company, and you also get the other people writing code for you. So open source projects are a win-win. Fifth is ego. Some people just like to think that they're important and that they matter, and speaking at a conference is one way to stroke that ego and get some recognition for your day job. Congratulations. Yay for you. Very few people will actually deserve it, because if you've been to a conference, you'll know that a lot of speakers are could use more work and to be interesting, perhaps. Sixth is competitive advantage. Showing your competitors that you have a strategic business over them can be a business strategy move, mm-hmm. where by showing them how much better than them you are, you're actually crushing their will to compete, or you're using it to encourage your competitor to make a foolish move, like move into the public cloud when they're ill-prepared to do so. And finally, the last one that I had was what I call the startup crash landing. You've got to remember that 90% of startups will crash. And what you want to be able to do is make the crash landing a little bit softer by getting your name out there and knowing other people in your industry. And so some public speaking and being public about your public cloud experiences helps you get recruited for the next job. Right? So with all of that behind it, is it no surprise that public cloud is all that you hear about? But if you think about what private companies are doing, they invest millions into making a competitive advantage. They don't tell their competitors what they're doing with their private cloud because their competitors can get the same thing. It costs money to send people and talk at these conferences. You've got to give away their time and resources. I mean, it literally costs tens of thousands of dollars to release somebody from a project for a week to go and speak at a conference. Mm-hmm. Some of the industries are highly regulated, and there are legal reasons as to why they're not allowed to talk. Banking, health, jurisprudence, legal systems. A lot of these people are just not allowed to speak. And even if they are, a lot of their talks have to go through the legal department before they're allowed to speak. And that's just too much hassle.
Or they get turned into mush that doesn't say anything.
Yeah, well. IT security is another thing. Some companies have IT security obligations that prevent you talking about what it is, because the more you talk about your internal app or your internal architecture, the more reconnaissance information you're providing to a determined attacker. Mm-hmm. People just, for some reason, just don't even think about that. If I can see your open source app, I can actually start to think about hacking. And then finally, there's brand security. A lot of people, employees speaking, many companies are very fearful around brand security, rightly or wrongly, but they don't like people speaking. So private clouds are private because very good reasons: money, competitive advantage, legal gain, you know, legal issues, you know. So you just don't hear about private cloud, in my view. And there's good reasons as to why not.
But it's also a shame because it seems like there's a lot of activity going on in private cloud and folks can benefit from private cloud. But if you just looked at, you know, what gets covered in the tech press, it's primarily public cloud. But again, for the reasons you outlined, because people who are doing private cloud have a lot of sensible business reasons to not talk about it.
Yes. And there are a lot of private clouds. So the numbers show that when we look at the numbers and they say, you know, enterprise, 70% of enterprises are increasing their spend in cloud. And then you scratch away at the numbers, it turns out that like the vast majority of the money isn't going to the public cloud, it's going to private cloud investments. Mm-hmm. They are increasing their public cloud spending, and the number's very large, but the actual total spend in public clouds is very small. So numbers I've seen sort of, you know, there's $1 trillion worth of IT, there's $300 or $400 billion spent in enterprise IT, argue over the number to yourself, and the amount of money spent in public clouds is like $15 to $20 billion. Mm-hmm. It's a fraction of the total spend. So even if it increases by, you know, 50%, that's still a fraction of the $300 to $500 billion we spend in enterprise IT. So
yeah, so it's unfortunate. And if you're working on a private cloud out there and you want somebody to talk to about it, we're all ears over here at Packet Pushers.
Tell us about it.
Yeah.
We'll keep it anonymous too.
Yeah. Or if you want to be public, we can put you on a podcast.
Yeah.
But this also brings me to another story that I found on Network Computing from Laurie McVitie. It's Why Private Clouds Need DevOps and SDN. And she does a nice job of just tying these three things in together, how private clouds relate to DevOps and SDN. These aren't just abstract concepts that sit in their own separate realms, that what you actually need is the idea behind a private cloud is that you're abstracting away all the things the end users don't need to see. But someone actually has to build that abstraction, and that's the DevOps and SDN side of it. That's how you operationalize the infrastructure. So it's a short piece, but I think it's a good read talking about how all these components fit into the notion of private cloud, and really that DevOps and SDN aren't means unto themselves, but they are stepping stones on the road to a more private cloud-like infrastructure.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, you're going to try to do all of this modern stuff, totally new ways of operating your applications, totally new operating systems, virtualization platforms, orchestration. And over here, you've got this heirloom assets stuck in a museum in special, you know, if you've been to those museums and they have glass cases that are full of like nitrogen so that they don't oxidize, you know, and if you poke them too hard, they fall down because they're 40 years old and they're, you know, it's a very difficult transition to make. And you don't hear the stories of how do I take my heirloom museum piece, enterprise technology that, you know what, is making a lot of money and is doing everything that you need it to do. And over here, you want to build the next generation, the next 20 years, and you've got to run both at the same time. That's pretty hard. I mean, coming back to that Netflix story, which was a real, you know, it took Netflix 7 years to move from their legacy to the cloud completely. And there's nobody, probably no company on the planet who has more expertise with running Amazon AWS and more expertise with developing apps in the most modern fashion that you can think of. And it still took them 7 years. So how long is it going to take a normal company?
Right. Right. Well, there's nothing in the article that says it's easy.
No.
But it has to be done.
As we'll see in the financial part of today, it does involve changing the way you spend money.
Mm-hmm. It does. All right, moving on. This story jumped out at me yesterday. Verizon chooses Viptela's SD-WAN. So Verizon announced that it's going to be using Viptela's software-defined WAN platform for a managed SD-WAN service. And apparently the deal that Verizon got with Viptela is that Viptela will be exclusive to Verizon, so Viptela doesn't get to use its technology with any other telco or tier one telco or service provider. Verizon kind of has them locked up. But I thought that was an interesting step for a little SD-WAN startup to take with a big company like Verizon.
Oh, it's amazing. First of all, that SD-WAN has come from, you know, although there are companies that have been doing software-defined WAN technologies for 10 years, really the last 2 years have seen it come out of complete obscurity to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And Verizon, which has historically been a, you know, allied with Nokia, Ericsson, Alcatel-Lucent, Cisco, you know, those types of companies, to sit there and say in their managed services division, forget all those legacy routing companies, we're just going with Viptela for managed services. So that's a lot of Cisco routers and a lot of Juniper routers that just suddenly got mm-mm.
Well, not necessarily, because Verizon is also partnering with Cisco for Cisco's IWAN SD-WAN offering. Yeah,
so I'm talking about managed services, right? Which
Where
Verizon manages WANs for companies. They're going to use
Viptela.
Viptela exclusively, apparently, which is a real coup. But those companies often own thousands and thousands of routers at the edge of their network.
I want to be careful about that exclusivity element. It's not that Verizon is going to be exclusive to Viptela. It's that Viptela has to be exclusive to Verizon. So Viptela can't then go to another telco provider like AT&T and say, hey, use ours. Verizon has locked in Viptela. Verizon can do whatever it wants. And in fact, Verizon Ventures, the venture arm of Verizon, has made investments in Versa Networks, which is another SD-WAN startup that focuses specifically on large enterprises and the telco carrier market. So yeah. Verizon is free to dance around with whoever it wants, but Viptela has landed itself and tied itself to Verizon, essentially.
That's annoying. Well, two ways to look at that. Pretty good deal. And also it limits Viptela's costs. It won't have to go and try and build a sales force that has to do business with AT&T or, you know, T-Mobile or something.
Because
mm-hmm. it's expensive to sell to telcos. It takes 10 years to get a deal off the ground sometimes. I think that's perfectly reasonable. Maybe they'll get bought out by then.
Yeah. I wonder, though, what that culture clash might be like, you know, for a fast-moving startup to run up against a service provider, and I'm sure Viptela is used to, you know, provisioning customers, getting them on board very quickly, and I don't think Verizon has quite the same turnaround. But we'll see. With a managed service, maybe they can make it happen. But it's also, I think, we've talked about this before, how SD-WAN, you know, could potentially be disruptive to the telcos and the carriers, and so hats off to Verizon for recognizing this and you know, moving with some alacrity into the space.
I think the managed services business units sit very differently from the others,
mm-hmm.
In that they don't actually integrate with the rest of Verizon. They actually sit as separate business units and have a different cash balance sheet and a different general ledger and things like that. And they're able to make these decisions independently of.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
In the same way that Cisco is full of business units and Juniper's business units and IBM's business units.
And there's a little bit of competition there.
Well, they, you know, this, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. We've seen that so many times over the years, and it doesn't actually matter all that much in the sense that they're moving in a particular direction or not. This is Verizon's managed services buying Viptela. Viptela's exclusive to Verizon. They're not going to go and sell it to somebody else. That's great news for them. And in the managed services portfolio, that means that the customers who choose to buy the Viptela service that Verizon, you know, customers have to agree to this. They'll be able to replace a lot of edge routers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is quite a win for Viptela if they can, and potentially damaging to an existing marketplace because, you know, take out several tens of thousands of routers at WAN sites and you've changed the shape of the revenue patterns for other companies.
That's right. Yeah, so definitely something else we'll be keeping an eye on. And now you're going to give us your sprint through some finance news.
Yeah, two things happened this week in the finance news that I thought we're talking about. One is Brocade announced its results. And in the face of a week when everybody's going down, Brocade managed to get up more than 5% on their share price on the back of fiber channel sales or storage networking decreasing less than expected. You want to work? Did you work that out? Did you get that?
I did work that out. It took a second. But...
So fiber channel sales are expected to decrease, but they decreased by less this year in this quarter. So only 2% down instead of, I think, a 4 or 5%. So they're actually well up because they made a lot more money than they expected because fiber channel's free money at this point. There's no further R&D going on. I did have a quick look at the scratch of their results and realized that 65% of Brocade's fiber channel sales are to OEM customers. What that means is they're not selling them direct. They're selling them through, you know, I guess, companies like AMC, Hewlett-Packard, Dell, so forth. So Brocade still has this massive fiber channel business that's making them money. But also importantly, against a backdrop where Cisco announced a reduction in sales in enterprise switching and routing of about 5 to 10%, I couldn't quite make sense of the numbers at Cisco, and I can't remember what they are, but Cisco had a pretty bad quarter for routing and switching and said the enterprise market was slowing down for them. Brocade was actually rising just 1%, but as we'll see in a moment with Arista, they're also up massively as well. So there's some weird stuff happening in enterprise switching and routing. Admittedly, these guys are rather small, so Brocade's revenues total is $500 million in the quarter. So a rise of 1% on $150 million is still good, but it's a bit different compared to Cisco's $4 odd billion in the enterprise switching and routing.
Right.
Arista also announced some results this week and absolutely stormed at home. They came home in Q4 right in the middle of what analysts estimated they would make, which is up substantially, like 40% or 50% growth on the same quarter last year. But most importantly, they predicted continued massive growth in Q2. So where Cisco was predicting drops of 5% next quarter and Juniper was down and all the firewall companies and load balancer companies are all down. Arista Networks is saying, hell no, we've got a lot more gear to sell and we're predicting we're going to continue to grow strongly in the next quarter. So people are flocking into its share price. Good for them. And probably we've covered the Arista lawsuit and you can probably see why Cisco's a bit needs to do something and the lawsuit makes sense.
Yeah, for sure, and I'd be curious to see with it going forward, the lawsuit, the patent lawsuit or the infringement lawsuit, how that will affect the actual sales as opposed to, you know, quarterly predictions. We may not see it in Q2, maybe Q3, but definitely something we will again be keeping an eye on.
The smart money seems to be saying that the lawsuit isn't having the traction that Cisco might have hoped for.
Yeah. As a strategic move, it doesn't seem to have blunted Arista at least at this point. So
nope.
Yeah, we'll watch. All right, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Thanks again to our sponsor, Riverbed, the applications performance company. And do keep an ear out for our upcoming weekly show podcast with Riverbed. That'll be available next week. Greg, in the meantime, if folks want to get more from you, where can they get it?
You can find me on my blog at ethereummind.com, on the Packet Pushers, of course, with podcasts and a range of other fine social media products like Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and so on.
All right, and I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at @Drew_CM. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with a friend. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find links to both of those fine publications at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.